Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 11, delivered on February 17, 2015. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, the time value of money. Probably at the heart of all that is finance is the idea that money has a value that is relative to time. By the time I'm finished, well, first things first. Do you remember anywhere in your dark arithmetic and math past in high school having to convert inches to centimeters and centimeters to inches, things like that?
Sure.
Yes. We all, somewhere along the line, we had to learn how to do unit conversions, kilometers to miles, gallons to liters. All I am showing you is unit conversion, because in finance, we need to convert now dollars to future dollars and future dollars to now dollars. It's a unit conversion deal. Now, the unit conversions you learned in math or in a physics class or something like that, or a chemistry class, those were what are called static conversions. It was always the same formula. 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. In our world, they are dynamic conversions because the conversion ratio would depend upon a couple of factors: how long the money is going to be sitting, and also what discount rate you're going to use to represent the time value. But it's still just a conversion of now dollars to future dollars or future dollars to now dollars. But it's the formula, you have to do it on the fly dynamically rather than having it right there for you at all times. To start this off, I'm going to do this. Madam, I could give you this dollar now, or I can give it to you in 20 years. Your call, which do you want? Oh, sure. Now is everything in your generation. No, there's no waiting for anything. I mean, Lord knows I waited for a meal until I was 50 years old. Obviously, it is worth more now than it is in the future. And that's all we're capturing in finance. Look, our cash flows do not all happen today at this present time. And when we do projects, the benefits and the costs from those projects, the money that comes in, the money that goes out, happens over a period of time. What we need to do is to create a thing that tells us everything now. In other words, what would this dollar be worth now if you get it in 20 years? It's obviously not going to be worth a dollar. It's going to be worth considerably less now. You would take maybe a quarter now instead of a dollar in 20 years. That's all we're doing, is recognizing that money decays in value as time goes on. And that decay has to do with how long you have to wait for it, and it also depends upon what you're losing by not having it now. So in other words, if I put a dollar away for 20 years, it's going to be worth a lot more in the future if interest rates are high. We have to recognize that interest rates are going to be that dynamic that I was talking about with unit conversions. The interest rate is going to determine how quickly the value of the dollar decays as it goes toward the future. Realistically, practically speaking, this is all just formulas. You write them down, and your calculator is your best friend for this, because especially these TI calculators, Texas Instrument 8384s, they have a whole facility for doing all these different kinds of calculations I'm going to show you. Sometimes you'll actually do it by the formula, because it's faster with the formula than it is with your calculator. But that's actually quite rare. Usually, your calculator is going to be much faster. Now, before we had calculators, do you know what we had before we had calculators? Well, yeah, and that didn't really rely. That wasn't too reliable. We had all kinds of devices before calculators to try to not have to do these calculations, because if you do these by hand, some of these formulas get to be an awful lot like work. In the interim, there used to be these tables, and I think they still have them at the back of your textbook, that would have like blocks. Here's how long the money was away. Here's what the interest rate was while the money was away. And you get the unit conversion. You do a sort of like a cross hatch until you found the right unit conversion to do it. Those tables were the bread and butter of banking, insurance, and all kinds of financial services. Students in finance classes had these giant books of tables to do the unit conversions based upon how long the money was away and how what the interest was while the money was away. The first one is very straightforward. The first couple. It turns out that you are actually related to Bill Gates. When he dies, you're going to get $20 million. You were a love child. And they don't want anyone to know about it, but you kind of found out that when he dies, you're going to get $20 million. The problem is that he's not going to die for a very long time. But, you know, let's say, well, we figure he'll probably live another 30 years. So we got to wait 30 years for that $20 million. Now, I'm a broker. Tell you what, you consign me. I'll take that $20 million when he dies, and I'll give you some money for it now. What would you take? You're not going to get $20 million right now. Get that out of your mind. I mean, I don't care if you want to buy those diamond pearl-studded gauges instead of those white things. But
take 15.
Okay, well, we'll work with that. But you see, what we are trying to do is figure out exactly what it would be worth, what you would give up $20 million for in 30 years for something now. That's basically what we're talking about. On the other hand, okay. Woman, you are about to give birth to your first child. This is just, no, let's try it. Okay, you didn't know it, but you sired a child. The child was just born, and you were just let in on this wonderful, wonderful thing. And once you stop running around the room screaming and slashing yourself with razor blades, you realize, I've got to take care of this kid. You know, I've got to make sure that this kid has the money to go to college at Illinois State University in 18 years. Wait a minute, he's got my genes. Okay, 23 years. So what would you, let's say, okay, I need to have $250,000 in the bank for him when he hits 18, so that he has his ride taken care of here at Illinois State. What would I have to put in right now for that money to grow to $250,000 in 18 years? That's the beginning of what we call financial planning. And that's what we do a lot of, is, okay, what are we going to have to, a couple comes to a financial planner, says to me, okay, here's what our goals are. We're 25 years old. We're up and mobile. We're making money. We're going to do a lot better as time goes on. But we want to plan for the future. We want to buy our first house with a really good down payment in 5 years. Okay? We're going to need to plan for that amount of money out there. How much do you have to put away for that now to have that happen? We want to have a second home down in a warm place in 15 years. Okay, we're going to have to figure out how much to put away now so that you can achieve that dream down the road. And then we want to have this nice, we want to have $5 million in the bank when we retire, and we would like to retire at 55. Okay, what are we going to have to do to achieve that goal out there in terms of money now and along the way? That's financial planning, and that's where one of biggest things about this whole thing I'm talking about, time value of money, comes in to the practical lives that you will live. Okay, let's start with this. We're going to do the basic lump sum formula. In other words, we're going to talk about just a pile of money, moving it forward in time, pulling it back from the future to now in time. And then we'll get into something a little more realistic in a while, though. But the lump sum. Now, the first formula that you'll have in the lump sum family is the future value of money. It will be the present value, the now value of the money, times 1 plus the periodic interest, K, the periodic interest rate to the number of periods that we are considering. You got to be a little careful here. See that K? K, okay. Your interest rate is, the interest rate on your money, madam, is 8%. So what would K be? This is not complicated. What's K? 8%. So what would I put into the formula for K? Say 0.08. Okay. No, you said okay, 8. 0.0, okay, no. No, that's not mathematical. 0.08, simple. Okay. And let's say it was for 5 years. So what would that T be in the formula? No, say it. Okay. 5. Yeah, yeah. What's the matter with you, teacher? Don't you know 5 years is 5? Okay, so K would be 0.08 and T would be 5. But suppose that the compounding were semi-annual. What would the K be if I said that it was 8%, but it's compounded semi-annually? What would the K be then? Huh? 0.04. You're still, be confident. 0.04, man. No. 0.04. Because twice every year. So the actual periodic interest rate is 0.04, 8 divided by 2. And what would 5 years, what would the T be with semi-annual compounding? No? How many compoundings would happen over 5 years? 10. You follow that? Okay, that's the whole idea, is that you have to know the periodic. So if I say it's 8%, you would put in a 0.08. 5 years, you put in a 5. But if I said 8% compounded semi-annually, you'd put in a 0.04, and you, for the T, you would put in 10, because it would have cycled 10 times during that 5 years. Okay, so in other words, it's divided by 2 on the K, divide on the K there, and up here, you multiply by the number of compoundings per year. Okay, so just one more time, just humor me. Okay, it's 10% semi-annual. So what would the K be? For 12 years. So what would the K be? It would be 0.12, right? Okay, so it's semi-annual, though. What would the K be?
0.06.
Bingo. And what would the T be? Remember I said 12 years? What would the T be?
24.
So you, in other words, with semi-annual, 2. Divide by 2 in the denominator, times by 2 in the numerator. Now, let's try it a little. Let's get butch. Okay, we're going to get rowdy. Quarterly. 4. You're good. You're good. Monthly.
1.
Woman, how many months are in a year?
12.
Bingo! Monthly. Because we always state interest rates, always annual. So if it's compounding monthly, that means that there would be 12 compoundings every year. So you would divide by 12. You follow me now? Okay. Okay, now, this is the one. I got to find someone. Really, madam, weekly. Yes. I have had students come up during an exam. How many weeks are in a year? Are you out of your mind? There's 52. Okay, weekly, you would divide by 52 in the denominator times by 52 in the exponent. Go ahead. Almost always. I mean, I'm not going to let you off the hook with an easy one. I'll always do some kind of compounding. But actually, even if I don't say compounding, you would assume annual, so it would be divided by 1 and times 1. So realistic. I'm going to explain that. There's a story behind that, okay? There is actually a story behind it. Humor me here. Okay, we've done semi-annual. We have done monthly. We've done weekly. Daily. Oh, wait. Oh, this one's rough. This one actually is. You, madam, daily. Not quite. Actually, the old school rule, and there are still places that, there are a lot of places that don't do it now. I think the book doesn't do it, but there are still a lot of financial institutions that use the old rule. If it's daily, you do 360 in the denominator, 365 in the exponent. Why 360? Well, the official reason always was, since the 1700s, that there are 360 banker's days in a year, five holidays. The actual reason is that 360, there's a trick rule for being able to divide by 360 real fast. But the official is there are 360 banker's days. Notice how that makes the actual interest rate that's in this little piece right here a little tiny bit bigger. And then it's 365 up here, which benefits by causing the exponent to be slightly bigger than it would be otherwise if it was 360. That's just the old rule, 360, 365. Now, you could go farther than that. There's actually some bank accounts that have instantaneous compounding. And I won't ever ask you about that because none of you are ever going to be rich enough to be able to get an account that has instantaneous compounding. But let me show you something here with this. First of all, just a quickie problem. Madam, you just inherited. Oh, how much did you inherit? Let's say $75,000. $75,000. Now, you look like one of those responsible people. I mean, look at this. This is responsible. The tasteful, modest glasses, the infinity scarf, and a reasonably well done in for having been done in 5 seconds ponytail. So you've inherited $75,000. So you go to your local banker, this fine, upstanding young stud, and you say, I want to put my money away so that, and I'm just going to take it out in 20 years, and in 20 years I'll have enough money so that I can do something really wild and crazy. Okay, I at that age, you know, I can buy, I can rent cougar bait or whatever. Okay? 20 years, you won't be it. You won't be. Okay, but, okay, so in this case, the present value of the money that she is going to put in is $75,000. Now, he tells her, well, you would qualify for one of our better certificates of deposit. We have a certificate of deposit with an annual of, let's say this one is actually 8%. And your compounding is monthly. And you want to put that away for 20 years. How much are you going to have at the end of this time? Well, this is actually going to be fairly simple. Just plug and chug is all these, really any of these formulas are plug and chug. And so you're going to just say, okay, we're going to have the future value in 20 years is going to be the present value, $75,000. Times 1 plus, now this 0.08, we'll divide it by 12, and then we will raise it up here to the 20 times 12 compoundings per year. So in other words, there will be a total of 240 compoundings on this money. As it cycles once every month, the amount of money is recalculated. Now, here's where I talk about, remember I talked about unit conversion? That is actually the conversion factor. It's like the 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. This is the 2.54 centimeters. This piece right here is actually the conversion factor for money at 8% compounded monthly for 20 years. Like I said, it's a dynamic conversion factor. It depends upon these three, the 8%, the monthly, and the years. But it's just a conversion factor. It will convert $75,000 now into what it is the same as in 20 years. Again, like I said, these are nothing but dynamic conversion factors we're using. The $75,000 isn't part of the conversion factor. It's just what you're going to convert. So if you crank that out, and I strongly encourage you to beat this one down on your calculator, make sure you can do it, is 70, well, let me actually do one thing real quick here. 1 plus 0.08 divided by 12 to the open parentheses 20 times 12. I strongly encourage you to try to string it as one calculation. Otherwise, you're going to get rounding error, and it's more likely you'll make a mistake. But if I do just the internal part here, that conversion factor I was talking about there, in this case, is 4.9268. It's a unit conversion. So in other words, if I want to convert any amount of money into another amount of money 20 years down the road, compounded monthly at 8%, I would use the conversion form factor 4.9268, yeah. That was what those tables were about. There was just this, just blocks of these conversion factors. Interest rates were along the top. You found the interest rate and the compounding rate, usually with the compounding. And then along the side, how many years it was. You run across and you find this thing right here. That's how we did it in the old days. Now we have calculators. We can do this without those big books of conversion tables. And anyway, so when I take that times $75,000, survey says, my ass. Oh, wow. Gee whiz. $369,510.21. Not bad. Patience, though. But that's kind of the basis of financial planning. You want something in the future, you're going to have to wait. And your reward for waiting is this 8% compounded monthly. That's the whole basis of any kind of financial planning whatsoever, is what you are going to get for giving up consumption now of money. In this case, $369,000. That's nothing to sneeze at. And, okay, from there. I was going to mention one more thing about this, but anyway. Now, we can turn around this formula. We can turn this formula around. So what I'm going to do is literally turn the sheet over. And we're going to do it again. We're going to do something backwards. Remember, the original formula was the future value is the present value times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods. We can turn this formula right on its head, quite literally, and say that the present value is the future value times 1 over 1 plus k to the t power. Just take the reciprocal of both sides. Now, the fancier way to do this that helps when you're doing the calculations on a calculator is, if you remember from algebra in high school or possibly in college, that you can actually write a denominator exponent as the negative of the exponent in the numerator. I usually do them that way. instead of trying to do 1 divided by and getting myself into trouble with parentheses, I just string it out, but I take the power as a negative, and that's the same as doing it as a reciprocal. That's your present value. So now we can answer your question. You go to your banker. 18 years from now, I want my kid to have $250,000 to go to college. What would I have to put in right now for that to happen? So in this case, we would say that I was at, well, okay, for 18 years, I could probably do 6% compounded quarterly. As long as you don't touch this money for 18 years. As long as you don't touch it, I can do 6% compounded quarterly for 18 years. So now we can find out exactly what you have to put in now to achieve that future value of $250,000. So in this case, we'll have $250,000 down the road times 1 plus 0.06 quarterly. What did you say that was? 4 to the negative 4 times 18. This is where parentheses will, you got to watch your parentheses, make sure that you do it right, because if you make a, I'm going to say something about that here in a minute. So pounding that out, and again, the little thing in the before, after the 250,000, that's your unit conversion factor. The dynamic conversion factor for 18 years is 6% on a present value compounded quarterly. So I'm going to hammer out that first part. I'm just going to do the whole thing. Try to run it as a single string and see if I can actually pull the thing off. 250,000 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.06 divided by 4, close the parentheses. Now we're going to raise that, and I'm going to put in a parenthesis, open parenthesis, the negative sign, 4 times 18, close the parenthesis, and hit enter, hoping that I get the answer. What? Oh, that kid can go find work to go to college. You know, really? Get a loan that'll destroy the kid's future. It does come out to be $85,582.50. There it is. That's all there is to it. If I put in $85,582.50 now into an account that bears 6% compounded quarterly for 18 years. In 18 years, $250,000 is going to be there in that account. That's how it works. Now I'm going to tell you something. Notice that present values are always less than the original. Future values are always more than the original. One nice thing about these formulas is that if you make a mistake, usually your answer will look ridiculous. It'll just a quick sanity check will tell you this can't be the right answer. Because you've got those exponents in there, your answer, if you do something wrong, key in something wrong, it'll just blow up or it'll turn into something tiny. And so there's that nice thing is that you kind of got to, well, I don't know if for sure this is right, but it looks like it's in the right ballpark. Okay. You can actually take it the other way. Say, what's the future value of $85,582.50 18 years from now at 6% compounded quarterly, and it should come out to be $250,000, plus or minus a penny because of rounding and all that. So now, with this present value, actually notice the present value is the one that is more important to us in business, because now we can talk about a project that's going to deliver money in the future. We're going to put money into it now. to start it. And then we'll start getting cash flow, positive cash flow from it over a period of time. This is how we can bring all of those positive cash flows back to the present and ask ourselves, the now value of the money we'll make from this, is it worth what we're going to spend for it now? We compare the cost, which we eat now, to the now equivalent of the benefit, the revenue from it down the road. That's the power of this formula. And even in your personal lives, this would be an important thing. You're like, oh God, please not me. Okay. You want to live the dream. That's why you're here at Illinois State. Now, and the dream for you is every man's dream. You want to move back to Decatur. You want to buy a house trailer, a double wide. You've got a double wide wife. And you are dreaming of having this trailer down the road. It's going to cost you a lot of money, and you want to have a down payment ready so that when you go into the bank, there's a higher chance that you will be able to get approved for a loan. So you figure this double-wide trailer, there's this used trailers place. It's called Earl's. It's on the south side of Decatur, right by that combination Baptist reading room and tattoo parlor. Okay. Yeah, right. I know, right? You know, but anyway, now Earl has said, look, you come in here in 5 years, I'll get you hooked up with a trailer. $50,000 is going to cost you. Now you think to yourself, I got to go to the Bank of Decatur. And the Bank of Decatur is going to say, we need a 10% down payment when you do this, okay? So you think to yourself, now, I'm going to put money in the bank right now so that I have the down payment for this in 5 years. Okay, a 10% down payment on a $50,000 double-wide trailer, we can do that easily. You go to the bank, you see that a certificate of deposit, 5 years, you can get a 4% compounded daily CD, 5 years, and you want $5,000 to come out of that in 5 years. That's an easy problem. So we would have the present value is going to be the future value, $5,000 times 1 plus 4% compounded daily, 360, to the negative of 5 years times 365. Yes, old school. I mean, it still looks a little impractical here because we're doing lump sums now. We will very quickly see how much you would have to put in every month for 5 years so we could achieve this dream of that trailer. So now we're going to go and do this. We're going to hammer out $5,000. And again, I'm doing this just so that you can get comfortable with doing these calculations. We've got these formula methods that are in the calculator that do the calculation for you. But for these basic lump sums, it's just as fast to do it on your own, by hand. Okay, and it's 1 plus 0.04 divided by 360, close the parenthesis, and now raise it, and don't forget to put parentheses when you do this. Open parentheses after you put the little hat in there. Excuse me. To the negative 365 times 5 years. Close the parentheses. So, the present value, you would have to put in $4,082.34 to achieve this goal. Notice that's actually not very great. The problem here is that what happened was that even though we had a very aggressive compounding structure, we were starting with a low interest rate that really wasn't doing a whole lot for us as far as earning money on our money. 4% just kind of sucked. And so you're going to put in about 80% of the down payment right now to have the down payment in 5 years. That is the bad part of low interest rates. Go. Explain. Mo, it's 0.34 because rounded to two decimal places will come out accurate to two decimal places, I hope. Yeah. It's a good question, though. Always don't do any rounding. If you're doing intermediate calculations, don't round because rounding will just explode on you in error, especially when you're doing exponents and all of that kind of stuff. Here's the deal. Right now, we are in this miserably low interest environment. Now, it's miserable on one end, but it's great on the other end. For borrowers, this is the greatest time ever for borrowing money. Interest rates are low and they're just hanging low. The Fed has been pouring money into the economy for years to keep the interest rates low, to stimulate the economy, wake it up, get it into its expansion mode. And for all the criticism you can make of the Fed and for the, you know, the massive spending program of $782 billion in 2009, it did wake up the economy. We are getting into a smooth expansion now, although there are still some rough spots. But those low interest rates also make saving a disaster. I'll tell you an interesting story. I have the Illinois State Students in Finance. We have all these events where speakers come and talk to us. And twice every year, we have ISU Finance alumni meet with the current finance students for luncheon. In the fall, we go up to Chicago. In the spring, we have it down here. Now, it was last year at the spring conference down here, we had some alumni from different companies around this area who are now doing professional finance stuff. A couple of them were from one of the big companies you would recognize in town here that have gotten into this quote-unquote wealth management. In other words, rich people's money, they're managing it for them. And that's a hot, hot thing right now, managing rich people's money. But there was an interesting thing. One of the heavies at one of these companies here in town, you'd recognize the name, as I said. She said during their discussion panel, she was asked, "Well, what's one of the biggest challenges you face right now in your career?" And she said, "I'll tell you what it is." She said, she was a graduate from like 12 years ago, 13 years. She said, "Back in the day, a person could come to us and have $1 million in the bank going into retirement." And what we could do is we could just set up a plan so that investments so that that person was earning an average annual rate of 10 to 12% a year. So that person was living the rest of his or her life or their lives on $100,000 to $120,000 every year. That's not a shabby retirement. She said, "You know what? How bad it is now? Someone comes to us with $1 million and they're going into retirement. They say, make that $1 million work for us so that we can have a good life in our retirement." She says, "I'm probably not going to be able to pull any more than 3% on their money. So that means that they're going to live on $30,000 a year in their retirement years." 10, 12 years ago, I could have seen to it that they were okay. They got, with relatively low risk in the investment portfolio, 10 to 12%. Now, with interest rates so low, it's great for borrowers, but think of people going into retirement. You'd think $1 million would be great and that would be enough to live a decent retirement? That's going to buy you $30,000 worth of cat food and a cheap place to live these days. So know that low interest rates have this dual thing. They cause borrowing to increase, which increases business activity for providing the goods and services that have been purchased through leverage. But at the same time, they also kill the savers who have to put their money in at those low rates. So what do these people, I've got $1 million. Can't you make me $100,000 a year? I mean, can't you do that? And of course, yes, we can. But here's a rule of finance. The greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you're going to have to bear. So here you are going to your retirement. You want to have an expected return of 10%. You're going to bear a hell of a lot of risk for that. So it's kind of like low interest rate environment definitely has brought our economy back from the dead. But at the same time, imagine what this is doing. This is wreaking havoc on portfolio management, financial planning for older people in this country. Even for this guy at 4%, man, you're still going to have to put in $4,000 now, give up that $4,000 for 5 years, just so you can have a lousy $5,000 in 5 years to buy that double-wide trailer you want. So the low interest rates have that downside as well as that upside to them. Okay, that is the idea of the lump sums. But I'm going to show you one last quick thing. When you compound more than once a year, what is happening is that effectively you are offering a little bit of extra money. Let me show you something here. Suppose that my compounding had been only once a year on his $4,000. Let's see what would have happened there. The present value, if it had been just straight up annual compounding, would have been 1 plus 0.04 to the negative fifth power. If I do that, $5,000 times 1.04 to the negative 5. What do you mean, error? Error my ass. Oh. times 1.04 to the negative 5. $4,109.64. Would have taken more. It would have taken more. On the other hand, compounding benefits the future value. Now, I'm going to do that calculation. Hang on here. Let's see if I can erase this. Someone's finally going to ask why all this ink is on this carpet. Oh, check that out, like a boss. Let's see what would have happened to the future value. Let me erase this whole thing. And I'm going to do a couple of quick future values. Really? Okay, let's take $5,000. We're going to do future values. Let's do 10 years. Let's do 8%. And we'll do compounded annually. And then we'll do semi-annual. And then we'll do quarterly, and I'll stop there because you'll see what's going on by then. This is the present value. We got 5,000 now. Let's see what happens to the future value as we increase the number of compoundings per year. Okay, cranking it through, the future value for annually would just be 5,000 bucks times 1 plus 0.08 to the 10th power. And then I'll just write the other ones down. For semiannual, it would be 5,000 plus 0.08 over 1 plus 0.08 over 2 to the 10 times 2. And for quarterly, it would be 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 over 4 to the 10 times 4. Cranking it through, just one after the other, 5,000 times 1.08 to the 10th power. Oh, that's not bad. More than doubled your money. Would come out to be $10,794.62. 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 divided by 2 to the 10 times 2 comes out to be $10,955.62. And finally, 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 divided by 4 to the 10 times 4, 40th power. What the heck? 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 divided by 4, close to the 40th power, $11,040.20. Oops, $11,040.20. Okay, enough of that. The number of compoundings drives the final value, the future value. The 8% was the same. The statutory rate stayed the same, 8%. It was the compoundings that changed, and that caused the final amount to become worth more. What this means is that there is the stated rate, but then there is the effective rate. Effectively, 8% is still 8% if it compounds once a year. But effectively, 8% is a little more than 8% if you compound it twice a year. And 8% is worth even more effectively if you compound it four times a year. That means that there is the stated rate, sometimes called the APR. But then there is also another rate, the effective rate, that is driven by the number of compoundings per year. And there's a formula. We can find the formula is actually really easy to find the effective rate. And I asked this on the exam, and for heaven's sakes, this is so easy. You should get it as a no-brainer. The effective rate is just 1 plus the periodic rate to the number of periods per year. So, annual would be 1 plus 0.08, one compounding a year. Semi-annual would be 1 plus 0.08 over 2 to the 2 times a year. Doesn't matter how many years, just how many times in a given year. And the quarterly would be 1 plus 0.08 over 4 to the 4th power, 4 compoundings a year. If I hammer those out, I'm going to get this. Minus 1, duh. Minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. Whew. Okay. So the first one, 1 plus 0.08 to the one power is minus one is, well, shock of all shocks, 8%. But 1 plus 0.08 divided by 2 to the second power minus 1 is 8.16%. Huh? Because actually, mathematically, there is no such thing as rates. Growth rates, decay rates, interest rates, all of those are actually one plus the formulas, the words that we use. We minus the one to turn it into something that we can talk about, that's familiar to us. This happens over and over with mathematical objects. With rates, the rate is a word, a descriptor, but what we use mathematically is one plus the rate. So when we want to bring it back to a rate, we have to minus the one to bring it back to our common terminology. Other places where you see this, mixed numbers. We will oftentimes talk, well, 1.5 cups. But you can't use 1.5 mathematically. You have to turn it into an improper fraction to do things with it. It's something that just happens in our way of talking about things, is that we talk about 8%. But mathematically, what we use is 1 plus 0.08%, 1.08. And finally, one last one here, after that arcane piece of information. Is 8.24%. Notice that the effective rate is actually increasing as the number of compoundings goes up. This is great news if you're a saver. It's bad news if you're a borrower. Because on a loan, the interest rate that you are initially told, 6.99%, it's actually effectively larger than that because you're making monthly payments, so interest is calculated 12 times a year. So the effective rate is higher. Under federal law, the disclosure of the effective rate has to be part of any loan agreement. Usually you will see the stated rate, the statutory rate, but then in the fine print or somewhere in your loan document, it will say, well, effectively this loan is at a higher rate. Now, here's the history of compounding. It's sort of hidden right there. Notice how the rate stayed 8%, but effectively it was going up above 8% as the number of compoundings per year increased. Long time ago, we had a time in American history called the Roaring Twenties. And before that, the wild times of the late 1800s and on, we had a very pro-rich, pro-business economic belief system in Washington and among most economists. You know, leave companies alone, let them do whatever they want. Well, this led to a lot of banking crises, runs on banks, fiascos. By the time we get to the 20s, quite literally, the rich were getting ridiculously richer, the poor were getting, and the middle class were getting poorer all through the 20s. It was the Roaring 20s. There was no regulation of the banking system, no regulation of the banking system, no regulation of the investments industry. It was just a wild west. Ponzi schemes, pyramid schemes, just out and out scams were all over the place. Banks were offering ridiculous interest rates to attract money. You see, I will give you 20% on your money if you'll put your money in my bank. Okay, now I will spend your money, just whatever I want to do. And then when you come in for it, I've got to find that money. So what I'm going to do is down the road, I'm going to offer you 30%. And then I'll take your money to pay you back some of yours, and I'll keep the rest for my pleasure. And then when you come in for your money, I've got to find other money, so I'm going to offer you 50% for your money. And then when you come in, I'm going to be able to give you your money back because he gave me $50,000. I'll be able to give you back your money with interest. You see the pyramid scheme going on there? This was legal. There was no one to stop it. It was just rampant, these kinds of ludicrous schemes. Invest with us for 400% return weekly It was just madness. Through the 20s, no one would stop it. It was just going crazy. And lots of course, eventually the whole scam would fall apart and I would move out of the area. No one would ever find me again and leave the last of the suckers holding the bag getting ruined. A lot of people lost their money, lost their pensions, lost everything they had in these scams that had been going on, for decades. It all came to an end in the crisis on Wall Street of 29. The banks just were folding up like paper mache in a hurricane. And finally, by the time we get to 1932, we were in a massive depression, the worst in American history. And the rascals were thrown out of Congress and thrown out of the White House. And hardcore banking reformers, securities law reformers, labor law reformers were all just flowed into Washington, and they were there to take names and kick ass. And they did. Even when the Supreme Court, which was appointed by all the presidents who had been the pro-business, pro-rich people, tried to stop it, the president at the time simply said, fine, if you want to try to find everything we do unconstitutional, I'll just add Supreme Court justices because the Constitution doesn't say there have to be just nine. There's no number. So I'll just pack the court. The Supreme Court finally realized that they had just found the answer to the question, who's your daddy? And they backed down. And so reform came to every industry, everything. Interestingly enough, reform came to the banking industry in the form of what was called Glass-Steagall. G-L-A-S-S-S-T-A-G-E-L. Glass-Steagall Act, which laid down the law and put the banking industry under the iron fist of federal control. No more games. No more of it. The Federal Reserve, which was supposed to be watching you, is nothing but your shill. We have the separation between the 1% and the 99% is ridiculous. You don't get out from under your part of the responsibility for this having happened. By the way, that separation of the 1% from the 99%, it's more now, and it's growing at a fast rate now than it did in the 1920s. That tells you the importance of bringing Glass-Steagall in. Glass-Steagall put a cap on the interest rate that banks could pay on savings account. 5.25%, no more. Realistically, because the government, the Federal Reserve was printing money like wild at the time to try to get the economy back on its feet, 5.25% was way more than the price of money. So banks, once they had got the word they weren't going to be able to stop this reform movement, they said, okay, yeah, 5.25%, because realistically, we're getting money at 2%, 1%, 0%. So yeah, offering 5.25%, we're never going to offer that anyway. So 5.25% in economic terms was what was called a price ceiling on interest rates, but it was not an effective price ceiling because the actual prices were well below the ceiling. The actual interest rates that banks needed to pay to attract investor money were much below that. But interestingly, over time, once the Federal Reserve began to pull back in the money supply, the price of money is interest rates, you began to see interest rates drifting up, and I had banks started having to offer more to their investors. Well, okay, we'll offer you 3.5%. Well, the money supply tightens a little more. Okay, 5%. And then they started, well, geez, the money supply has been tightened, and 5.25%, boy, that's barely enough to attract investor money away from alternative investments. And then it got more serious. 5.25%, there were financial institutions that weren't under Glass-Steagall that were offering 5.5%. And that's when the genius, the bankers looked at Glass-Steagall, and it said very clearly, the annual rate on a passbook savings account could not exceed 5.25%. but it said nothing about compounding. So the bank said, wait, if we offer 5.25%, we are meeting the letter of the law. But the letter of the law doesn't say that we can't compound semiannually to bump the interest rate up above 5.25% effectively. And as the competitive environment for capital savings money got more aggressive, okay, we'll just go to quarterly compounding, bump our effective rate up even more so we stay competitive. That's where compounding actually started, was when banks got to the point where their cap, this price ceiling on savings, became effective, and they had to find a way to go over the price ceiling while still maintaining the letter of the law. So they did it through the compounding. It still prevented them from going way over. They couldn't offer the moon. But, of course, the federal regulators sat back and said, well, this is okay because, I mean, compounding, like even daily, isn't going to really drive them, give them the ability to offer ridiculous interest rates, but it will give them the ability to offer interest rates that are higher than Glass-Steagall allows. And we don't have to amend Glass-Steagall to take care of this, because we don't want to amend this law because the bankers are going to start pouring money into congressional districts to get favorable, and then we'll blow the ceiling right all completely away. Okay, that's the history of compounding. But inside of that is the history of Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall sounds like a really cool law. It keeps the banksters from misbehaving. It makes them act responsibly. And even when the Federal Reserve falls down on its job, Glass-Steagall is there so that the comptroller of the currency, the Treasury, can bring the fist of Glass-Steagall down on banks. There's only one problem with it. Glass-Steagall was repealed in 1999. It was completely wiped away. And hence, the 21st century opened with a Wild West of the 1920s back in effect in the banking system. There is no Glass-Steagall now, and guess where you could probably source the financial disaster of 2008? It was probably because there is no law, other than the regulations of regulators, if they want to stop banksters from doing whatever the hell they want with your money. That's all I have for you. I thank you.